Well, this is the 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference for the 28th of June, 2017. Craig, you want to call a roll?
Okay, I will read what I have already here. Cheryl Curtis, David Cole, James Hufford, Mick Harrison, Pat O'Connell, Ken Freeland, Dan Hennen, Barbara Honegger, Barry Zwicker, Jane Clark, Michael Springman, Wayne Costi, Peter Ketchum, Dwayne Dietz, Neil Marquis, Frank Tolopko, Charles Ewing Smith, and yeah, that's what I have so far. Did I miss anyone?
Stu Nelson.
Stu Nelson. Okay.
Stu, I don't see you on here. Are you calling under on someone else's phone, or let's see. Do either of you guys see him, Ken or Craig? Do you see his name on the list?
I don't.
Maybe it's under Smith and Clark. Is that possible? No, that's Smith and Clark. Is
That's Jane, right?
Jane.
That's
Me. No, I don't see it either. It's very odd. I don't see any O'Connell, Patrick O'Connell, maybe.
Yeah, that's it. It's Pat O'Connell. Yes, that okay. Should be the same as Stu Nelson.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so Craig, are you ready to call the roll in? Or you have called the roll?
I have called it. There's a couple of people that I wouldn't mind just double checking to see if there's any particular affiliation I should be including in the minutes. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple and you may have given this to me in the past, but I may have just forgotten. But Mick Harrison, are you with a particular group?
Mick,
or?
Mick is a guest. Mick is a guest.
Oh, of course you are. Yes. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
He's with lawyers for 9/11 inquiry.
Right. Okay. That's right. I knew that. And Stu Nelson, are you with a particular group or just on your own?
Well, Pat and I were the regional coordinators for TAP or A&E 9/11 here in Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma. Since that's
okay.
Been handed off to, I think Glenn Anderson is running that now, but anyway, that's what our affiliation is.
Okay. So if we were just shortening that, could we just put you as TAP then? Would that be?
Yeah, that's fine.
Is that okay? All right. Great. So I think I'm – and Neil Marquis as well.
Yes, I do volunteer work for architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth with Andy Steele and Kelly Davis.
Okay, great. I'll put you down for that. Okay, so I'm good, Ken.
All righty then. Well, I'm having a little email trouble here, so I don't have the draft agenda in front of me. But, I'm sorry, we need to do the minutes first. Are there any objections to approving the minutes as posted by Craig? Hearing none, then
actually,
we'll take 2 minutes for proof. Huh?
Actually, Ken, sorry, me again. One thing I didn't have when I put it together, which I would have had if I'd given myself more time, was Frank's email, because he wanted people to contact him about the not A thing. So I just wondered if Frank, you wanted to have us include your email address in the minutes.
I did receive one response, so if somebody had my email address, but yes, include it, franktolopko@gmail.com.
franktolopko@gmail.com. Okay, I'll do that.
No, it's not Frank Tolopko, it's Frank Tolop. I leave off the KO at gmail.com.
Oh, so it just, okay, so it's the last two letters of your name that you're leaving off?
Yeah, that's correct.
Tolop. Okay, got it.
Well, Craig, do you think we should republish the minutes then to get that announcement out of the...
Yeah, I figured I would just make that addition and just send it to you again, if that's okay.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering if it should go back out over the whole thing in order to publicize that for him, or if it's...
I don't mind doing that, sure.
Yeah, I kind of think, you know, if you're going to take the time to do that, we probably ought to do it that way so that people have the opportunity to see that you know, in a timely way.
Yeah. I sort of checked the recording trying to find reference to it, but I don't know if it was mentioned in the phone call last time. But yes, I can send it all. I can send it out again.
Okay, and then I'll just use your second draft for the minutes for next time, and for the posting. Okay.
Oh, okay. Right.
Okay. All right. So again, I'm having trouble pulling up my email. So does anybody have any trouble with the agenda as formulated tonight, the draft agenda? Any additions or critique? Well, good.
It's Barb. I think I sent you an email that if it's okay with Cheryl, I'd like to just give a short reaction to the left forum as well.
You can do that on announcements or something, but it's not agendized, okay? Unless you want to make it agendized. If you'd like to propose it for an agenda item, we can do that here.
Announcements would be fine. Wherever Cheryl is going to be talking about it, then I'll just
I told you in my response to you, that was from the minutes that you got that. It wasn't from this week's draft agenda, okay? You misconstrued it. That was a report from last week that was covered.
Okay, well, I recommend that we have a short agenda item to let people know about the very important left forum.
Okay, how much time would you like for that?
Well, it's up to Cheryl.
Well, we did talk about the left forum last week, is what I'm saying, last month, okay?
Yeah, but that was before it happened.
Yeah, I think maybe 10 minutes.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Okay, if that's the case, yeah, we should do some report.
I would do three to five minutes. I mean, that's just a guess.
Yeah. Okay. So, any objection to including that at the end of our agenda, a review of the left forum? Okay, hearing none, then we'll just top that off at the end. Okay, so our first honored guests tonight are from the Lawyers for 9/11 Inquiry, and I think you all noted from the draft agenda that we've all been sort of following this question of what the Lawyers for 9/11 Inquiry are doing since they made their decision to go ahead with litigation on 9/11 issues. And we're very privileged tonight to have with us the chairwoman, Jane Clark, and Nick Harrison, who is named the litigation director for the Lawyers for 9/11 Inquiry to give us a really comprehensive update. So with no further ado, Jane or Mick, whichever, feel free to take it.
Jane, do you want to start?
Well, okay. I think I was given the task to kind of tell everyone what exactly, how we got started and where we're at to the present, and the legal I'll leave up to Mick.
Okay.
He's a federal lawyer. We started back in February of 2014, and it really started from out of AE 9/11 Truth. A paralegal was a volunteer there. Her name was Susan Watson, and she started it. She started gathering all the names. Richard gave her the names. Richard Gage gave her the names of lawyers that were on his list, and she started contacting them. She wasn't with us too long. She died in April of 2014. And from that point on, of course, it had just gotten started, and the attorneys were a little bit freaked out when someone was dead right away. So we had our first notice of a meeting that it kind of fell on me to try to contact everyone to start trying if we could gather lawyers at all. We were pretty new at everything. So we kind of initially started meeting once a week, and we still do to this day, to create some goals, create a website for a depository. It's a private website. It's only for the attorneys. And it's a depository that we put things we find as we go. And then we had we just kept meeting, creating goals, and at some point in time we decided that we needed to incorporate and go toward a public law firm that would address all these issues in 9/11. And, of course, it was a learning curve for a lot of attorneys that, of course, they didn't think things were right, but we just did have a lot of learning going on for quite a while until we incorporated and realized that we had to do something. So I think, Mick, I'm not sure what, I think we incorporated in late 2015? I can't remember.
That's right. I don't.
2016. Do you remember?
I'm thinking December, but I don't have it in front of me.
Okay. And from there, the Justice in Focus program got started, and that was one of our first big projects. But, of course, FOIA is a big interest to us, and luckily we had David Cole and that had been doing research for, good gosh, since it happened. And I think to date we have about 30 FOIAs that we're looking at, but one that's only in court. Of course, these things take money, so that's what we're at on the FOIAs, even though we have them in appellate levels and some are ripe to go to court. So if you haven't seen the Focus and Justice videos, that gives you a better idea of what we're doing. And Mick just went to Colorado, and he can give you his video that can be sent out to anyone that wants it. It's on YouTube. Gives you a good idea of what we're doing now. We're trying to gather enough money. We have committees built already, petition committees, funding committees, membership. Continuing legal education is not started yet, but we are in the process of trying to get the attorneys to submit continuing legal education credits for lawyers in every different state. There's probably about 50 on my list. We're getting new ones here and there, and an investigative committee, and we have a couple more. So we're rocking and rolling along with not a whole lot of money, but we are determined, and that's. I'll open it up to questions on that if anybody has any.
And then after that, Mick will talk about the litigation strategy and so forth?
As far as he can, yes.
Okay. All right. Any questions for Jane regarding the history of lawyers for 9/11 inquiry and how they've come thus far and where they're trying to go financially and so forth?
Ken, are we in the mode where we can do that, or you just want us to speak out?
Yeah, we're right now. It's open mic, I guess. So
oh, okay. Because I have a question, Cheryl.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
Jane, if we wanted to donate, where would we donate? How do we do that?
We have a website. It's a Lawyers Committee for 9/11, 9/11. What is it, Mick?
I think it's Lawyers Committee for, the short version, which is... Dave Cole probably has that memorized better than I do. I think it's lcfor911.org.
Okay.
Dave will correct me, maybe.
Well, maybe you could email us. We'll put it in the minutes. That'd be great.
Yeah,
just a second question. This person who died, who kind of got this started, was there anything fishy about her death? Or?
You know, I don't really know. She was a paralegal. She had... been in California. She had gone to Kansas to take care of her mother that died and take care of her estate. She told me she, and I don't know, she said that she had been implanted with some implants. And I think some of her interest in the group was to try to find lawyers to go to federal court to deal with her issue as well, besides 9/11. She said that she had some sort of nanotechnology that had been implanted in her, and her experts, as far as the federal case goes, would not fly. And then I tried to tell her that, but she said, "Well, you don't understand. Most doctors won't understand the things that I'm going through." And I don't know if she was actually one of those like targeted individuals, like you hear about that. Mm-hmm. I think Jesse Ventura has. We know the government's been messing with people.
I
don't really know, but she did hang herself. And there were things written all over her wall she said that the government was torturing people. I don't know if I was dealing with someone psychologically off or someone that really had a genuine problem that she was dealing with, but she always seemed very organized. So that scared a couple of lawyers off, you might say, right
yeah.
off the bat.
Yeah.
And you know, she was she was really a pretty smart gal. She was organizing continuously the lawyers, but she wasn't on the group for more than about a month and a half.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Was this the D.C. madam?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, she was a paralegal.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay. Any other questions for Jane before we move on to hear what Mick has to say? Okay, well, hearing no other questions, then Mick, the floor is yours. Go ahead. Welcome.
Thank you. Is everybody able to hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So starting 2 days from now, I will be the first executive director of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 inquiry. As Jane mentioned, we are incorporated. We are 501c3. We have adopted a mission, and the basic goals of the organization are to promote transparency regarding what happened on 9/11, what led up to 9/11, and what has transpired since because of 9/11, and to promote accountability for the unprosecuted crimes of 9/11. Including promoting justice for the victims of 9/11. So those are our overriding goals. Our basic approach is to use what I call a campaign approach, which is a combination of investigation, litigation, public organizing, and education in a more limited fashion, working with Congress as we're allowed to under our 501c3. We will be doing some petitions. Someone might want to go on mute there who has the background noise. Petitions to agencies. One of our first major projects will be the filing of a petition to the Attorney General of the United States and certain U.S. attorneys requesting a federal grand jury, and we can talk more about that if you wish. We also intend to have a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act campaign. Jane mentioned we've started one FOIA litigation for David Cole. This is the case against FEMA, which also involves NIST, the National Institutes of Standards and Technology. David requested all the essentially raw data, background documents that were used to prepare the FEMA building performance study. And we've now, after filing suit, when David didn't get the documents he requested for a couple of years, we did file suit, and we have a forced release of most of those documents. We're still trying to get the remainder, which appear to be the key documents that have been withheld. We're hoping to get discovery, and we're waiting on a judge's decision, which is expected momentarily, which we hope will be granting us discovery rights to subpoena and depose certain people from FEMA and NIST and to acquire some of the records to determine what happened to these key records that are missing, so that the FOIA campaign is expected to expand into several areas, which we can talk more about that if you wish and your questions. So in addition to the litigation, and we do have some concrete ideas for litigation, some of which we can talk about in a moment, and some details we cannot because they're still in the formative stages, but we do expect litigation to be a major component of what we're doing. We are primarily lawyers. We're not limited in our board of directors or our support group to being just attorneys. We have investigators like David Cole, and we're open to scientists and other folks from a variety of backgrounds. But we do have a number of attorneys on our board, and we expect to maintain a majority of attorneys on the board so that we can make litigation decisions with
and
those
Ed
folks.
Ed Asner, Mick.
Well, we now have the pleasure of having Ed Asner join our board. To my knowledge, Ed is not a lawyer, but we don't hold that against him. we've had our first meeting with Ed, and he was very, I thought, very productive and made a good contribution to our first meeting, very insightful. So we look forward to working with him. We do expect to have a media component. I expect you all know more than I do how challenging that will likely be on this issue, mm-hmm. but we intend to work on getting some attention from both alternative media and mainstream media, and some investigative reporting. That will be an interesting strategy as it develops. We also expect to have a whistleblower component. As some of you know, I'm a longtime whistleblower lawyer, have been representing whistleblowers nationally for 25 years. Started out at the Government Accountability Project doing that, still doing that. And I hope to come up with a campaign. We may need to raise some money to do this, to encourage 9/11 whistleblowers to come forward. We expect to do that in a couple of ways beyond simply advertising what we're doing to bring out the truth. But one of the ways is I hope to raise money to offer a reward for whistleblowers who bring significant information forward about the unprosecuted crime of 9/11. And I also hope to offer whistleblowers who do come forward free legal assistance in representing them if they need to have representation as an incentive for them to come forward. And we can talk more about that strategy also if you wish. The petition for the grand jury will focus on, for the moment, and when that may expand before we file it, but the immediate focus would be the hard scientific evidence of the use of explosives in the World Trade Center buildings that collapsed. We're not opposed to investigating other areas, and our investigative committees that I expect to be setting up shortly will be looking at other areas. That would include the Shanksville incident as well as the Pentagon. We'll be looking at obstruction of justice issues more broadly. So we're going to do more than just the evidence that's been well developed at this point by the architects, engineers, and scientists. So we're going to need to raise some money for all this, of course. At the moment, we're working sort of on our own dime with our own donated time, and we've raised a very modest amount of money. But we're looking to break through and raise some significant money from individual donors as well as foundations. So I think we can probably stop there. And then if you want to know more about some particular aspect of our plan, I'm happy to answer questions.
Well, Mick, I can't tell you how refreshing it is to hear somebody with your legal background using the term repeatedly, the unprosecuted crimes of 9/11, but it is extremely refreshing. And I hope that others have some questions to help lead your comments in the direction of more information. So who would like to start?
This is Wayne.
Wayne, go ahead.
Yeah. So I think the name is Richard Lambert. I think he's was in court about the anthrax issues. So are you going to be dealing with the anthrax issues? And is there anything about the Richard Lambert, if I've got the name right, legal case? Over.
Well, we've talked to him. One of the attorneys in our group has talked to him. He was involved in a federal suit that he filed himself. And we're going to try to follow up on with him. We don't know. He is a lawyer himself, and he also was the FBI agent in charge of the anthrax investigation. I don't know whether or not he's retired now in Tennessee, or possibly he's working now. I don't know. But he more or less talked to Bill Jacoby, who's our secretary, and gave him the...
Hey, guys, I'm back.
Okay.
Hey, this is Mick. I got cut off there just as I was about to address Wayne's inquiry. And you should know that when I call back in, it takes me twice to put the code number in before it works.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what's going on with that.
Let us
know
well,
that... Jane responded to the question.
Could somebody remind me what the question was?
Regarding
Wayne, you
want
to repeat
Lambert.
The question? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Well,
okay.
If you want me to ask the question again, the question was about Richard Lambert and anthrax and the status of the status of his case. That's Jane already gave us a little background on it. So, over.
Good, Jane. Did you finish, or did I interrupt you?
No, that's all right. This case is over. He lost. So we don't know what he's doing right now, but we do plan on following up with him, and I don't know if he's interested in our group or not. We're hoping he will be. but he let us know that he thought the government pretty much gave him a bunch of green FBI agents to help and did block some of his work. That's what we know so far.
So just to add to Jane's comments, it is my interest, and everything I do as executive director will have to be approved by the board, and I don't know yet whether the board will approve, but it's my intention to include the anthrax issue in one of our investigations. So I expect we'll have a committee looking at that at some point. I have some sort of historical interest in that issue because one of my whistleblowers' clients was a chemist from Dugway Proving Ground, and he had, among other things, disclosed that there was very lax security in terms of access to biological and chemical weapons, at least in the old days, at Dugway. And they actually, even in recent days, this was after 2001, were still mailing anthrax through FedEx, which I found interesting.
Wow.
That came out in our trial. So I'm interested in following up on that myself. And one of the questions I would like to eventually get an answer to, and please, I know you're recording the call, and that's fine, but what I'm stating now is a question to be answered, not an opinion or a conclusion at this point. But one of the things that I would like to get to the bottom of eventually, if assuming the board supports this line of inquiry, is to find out whether there were planes, additional planes that were used. And I realize there's a controversy within the movement about whether the original planes were actually used, but I won't get into that in a moment. But one of my hypotheses, not really a theory yet, is that there were planes that were intended to be used on 9/11 that were never actually used, and whether that was from the original hijackers or from neocons or some other group is another question. I think one or more planes probably got either stuck on the ground or had other issues that prevented them from reaching their target. And Building 7 sort of begs that question, since it was brought down later in the day without being hit by a plane. But the anthrax thing may beg the question also to me, and again, it's just a question at the moment, and that is because one of the convenient things that the anthrax scare allowed to happen was an evacuation of a key building in the Capitol. And I won't belabor that, but I think that's a line of inquiry that needs to be pursued. So I'll stop there and take other questions.
Fascinating, fascinating. Okay, who else has a question or comment?
Barb.
Go ahead, Barb.
Yeah, I have a question, but a quick addition to Richard Lambert. For Mick and Jane and everybody, many people don't realize, but it was in the New York Times, and it blew my mind, and I reported it to the group back then. That's like 2 years ago, maybe. But Richard Lambert, in his position at the FBI, he was not only the agent in charge of the investigative agent in charge of the anthrax investigation, and critical information was withheld from him, including by the FBI's own laboratory, that did have DNA from the envelopes and withheld that information from the so-called head of the FBI's anthrax investigation. But in addition to that, amazingly, and directly 9/11 related, at least as far as the official story of 9/11 is concerned, he was also the investigative FBI agent in charge of the investigation of the two alleged hijackers, the only two that are mentioned in the 28 pages, both of whom happen to have been on the alleged Pentagon plane. So he's very, very important if we can get him as a whistleblower. And I think he might be open to that, Mick, because he, when he talked to, as I recall, Bill Jacoby, he said he was open to actually speaking or at least coming to our 9/11 conference 2 years ago, but was doing something else at the time that he already was pre-scheduled for. So I really think he is a major opportunity as a witness.
Yeah, understood. Appreciate that, Barb.
I think what happened to him is what he did was nothing different than what most of federal employees do. They go from the job they have into retirement, and then they go into another position with some sort of government contractor. And they it was his opinion they misread the legal aspect of whether or not he could do that, even though others had. And he believes it was because of his opinions on the anthrax case itself that really led to the government actually, he lost the jobs that he had lined up when he retired. But he didn't feel like the anthrax investigation was taken seriously by the government. He felt like it was underfunded. He felt like he was just given a lot of young, inexperienced FBI agents. And he didn't agree that the scientist that they allegedly committed, that committed suicide, was the one that it was pinned on. He said it wasn't him because the anthrax that they had analyzed was not the same as what that was at the where the scientist that they pinned it on. They didn't make it there the same. It wasn't the same.
Yeah, Fort Detrick, I think.
Right, Fort Detrick. He said it wasn't him, but they never analyzed the evidence they've got.
Okay. For Craig's reference, I see Michael Cook has joined the call.
Hi, everybody.
Also,
thank you.
Also, Bill Wilt.
Bill Wilt also, yep. And we already have Mary Switzer. Okay. Okay, so any other questions for our two distinguished visitors from the Lawyers for 9/11 Inquiry?
I have one kind of point I'd like to raise, if I might.
Go ahead, Bill.
There's been a, you know, the joke about alternative. What is it? Noise.
That's right. I'm going to mute Barbara for a bit. Barbara, I'm going to have to mute you because there's a lot of background noise there. Go ahead, Bill.
Alternative facts. Remember that? Now, it turns out, I looked at the federal civil practice law and rules or whatever it's called, and there actually is such a thing in pleadings as alternative facts. And what they are is you can plead. The example was given of a guy sued because his dog bit the neighbor. The neighbor sues. And the defense is, one, I don't have a dog. Two, my dog has no teeth, which is you can see the conflict there. I was walking my dog on a leash and wasn't at home when the incident occurred. I can't remember the other. There were four examples of mutually exclusive fact patterns, which are alleged as, quote, alternative facts. Now, this is kind of funny. It's not that alternative facts are a lie, as one reporter put it on national TV, but it's that there are alternative facts, which... I'll just ask, Mick, if you plead some alternative facts, however outrageous they may be, and my instinct would be to go for as outrageous as possible, that this might be an attention-getting thing for, you know, for the press and the public at large. You know, not so as to mess up the case or do any damage to the pleadings, but still. And I know Danny pointed out that when you're doing a case like this, you don't get to do alternative pleadings. You get what
okay,
you got.
Okay, Bill, let's let him respond. Okay, you want to respond to that, Nick?
Sure. First of all, I think the rule you're thinking of there allows alternative pleading, but it's primarily used for alternative legal arguments or legal theories, either for the plaintiff or the defendant. Generally speaking, though, you're talking about different rights to recover or different legal bases to defend. You're generally not asserting contradictory facts in the same case. My experience is judges frown on that, and they probably would find that if you asserted one fact theory in the case, you, particularly if you prevail on it in some way, you would then be a stop from asserting an alternative fact theory.
Sure.
in the same case. Now, initially, when you're doing discovery and developing your case, you probably will get by with laying out different alternative ways of either proving your case or, if you're the defendant, defending. But at some point, you have to bite the bullet factually and say, here's our theory, fact theory of the case, and
right,
try to prove that up. Now, I mean, our goal is to prove what happened and to help the public learn what happened. It certainly will be my approach to not seek attention prematurely to what
right.
we're doing, and to not seek attention on the basis of something that is simply fascinating, interesting, or even outrageous to the public, unless it happens to be something that we can prove with evidence in hand. I'm a fairly conservative litigator, which, and I think you have to be more so in an issue like this, because you need to maintain your credibility. And so you don't want to go beyond your evidence. Now, that doesn't keep you from going broad in your discovery and trying to gather evidence in areas you may not have developed it yet. The trick, as some of you know, and Jane is very sensitive to, I know, is on this issue, historically, folks who brought 9/11-related litigation have not been given the opportunity to do discovery. They never got that far. They got
right.
dismissed on a motion to dismiss or maybe summary judgment without having discovery, which isn't supposed to happen. So our trick, our challenge, is to try to get discovery based on legitimate evidence in hand, and I think that's one area where you all can help us. We don't want to have to reinvent the wheel and have to duplicate everyone's, you know, 15 years of research on key issues. So you're all invited to communicate through Jane or I, or eventually if you want to join one of our investigative committees, to help us learn from what you've already discovered. So we can maximize the evidence in hand. We may have gotten the opportunity to do discovery, which is very rare in FOIA cases, Freedom of Information Act cases, in David Cole's case. And the only reason we're in that position is because of the excellent homework that David Cole had already done on the case. And so he had a very strong position based on his knowledge of documents from the agencies, and we could, you know, explain to the judge why records they didn't give us are known to exist based on other records we do have. And that's the approach we want to use in other cases, even more ambitious litigation. You know, we have to start with what we know and use that as leverage to get the right to discover additional evidence.
Nick, would you like us to put your and Jane's contact information in the minutes for the reference of others who may wish to communicate with you regarding evidence?
I would certainly put my information in. I'll leave Jane to say whether she wants her information in.
I'm fine
okay.
with that.
Okay.
I might want to say that who he's referring to on that alternative pleading is a criminal defense lawyer out of Texas that just died this year. His name was Richard Racehorse Haynes.
Oh, yeah.
And what he actually said was that his defense was, my dog doesn't bite. Second, in the alternative, my dog was tied up that night. Third, I don't believe you really got bit. And fourth, I don't have a dog. So I just
you
wanted to bring that up
as
one of the Texas lawyers.
Thanks for the clarification.
Okay. So any other quick questions before we move on to our next topic? Because we're almost out of time on this one.
This is Cheryl. I just have a quick one.
Sure.
Can you tell me, either of you, how many people you have working with you in this committee?
Jane, do you want to try that?
Well, we have several committees.
I think she means the lawyers' committee overall.
Maybe 10 to 15.
Oh, you could have kept on this.
About
10?
Yep.
Okay, and then my second part of the question is just quickly, are you guys ready to do a radio interview on this now, or are you waiting to get more things going? Or
depends on what the topic would be. I'm okay with a radio interview now on the committee, the lawyers committee, and what we're doing. There are certain things that may be questions we couldn't answer depending on what's asked, but I don't see a problem. Jane, do you with a radio interview?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Our biggest focus right now is trying to get funding because, 9/11 is just the icing on the top. This group probably knows that, but that has got to be our focus. But we do hope for a long-term public interest law firm dealing with 9/11 and probably at some point deep state.
Okay, great. So I'll contact you through
the
email.
Funding is important, yes.
And,
this is Chuck Smith, I'm working with the Lawyers Committee, and I'll be shooting a video with Ed Asner next week.
Okay.
Woo-hoo.
Wow.
So we're starting our PR campaign. He's got a nice 5-minute performance ahead of him.
Excellent. Uh-huh.
Thanks, Chuck.
Sounds promising. Okay. All right. So with that said, we want to thank both Jane and Mick for taking the time to share the current status of the committee with us tonight and its ambitions. And we look forward to supporting them as much as we can in the future and for them keeping us in the loop as to how we might do that. Okay. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you. Are we okay to drop off the call?
Thank you.
You're okay to drop this call. If you want to remain, okay. You're welcome, but you don't need to if you don't want to. Okay? If you have
Well, thank you very much. Take care, folks.
Thank you.
And so now we move on to our second major presentation tonight, and that will be someone with a new book, and that's Jay Michaels. And Cheryl will introduce him. Go ahead to introduce Mr. Springman.
Okay. Michael, probably everyone on the call knows him, but anyway, I will do an introduction. J. Michael Springman, he's the author of the book Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handbooks That Rocked the World, that came out a few years ago. He's an attorney and a former diplomat with the U.S. Department of State. As a diplomat, he spent 5 years in Germany, 2 years in India, and nearly two in Saudi Arabia. And he's on the call tonight to tell us about his new book, which is called Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos. Michael?
Okay, I'll try and give you, I guess, the 25-second introduction. The book is essentially a follow-on to my first book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, in which I talked about how the United States organized an international terrorist conspiracy, starting out with the Mujahideen and then the I'm branding them yet again as ISIL or IS or Daesh.
Hey, Michael,
whatever you want to
call
it.
Your microphone seems to be cutting in and out, or your voice does.
No, that's really strange. It happens a lot for some reason, and I don't quite know why. If you want to hang on, I will try to a different part of the house and see if I can get something done here.
Are others experiencing the same thing?
Yes.
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 Okay.
Well, the oddball thing is, it a lot of times I have no problem with it, and it only happens when I'm talking to people about cues on the books or international affairs or something like this. Am I coming through any better now?
Sounds like it might be, yeah.
All right, let me move farther up then, and I don't know what it is. I thought about using the Skype, but then the people have issues with that. How is this now?
Seems to be okay.
All right. Well, we'll go back to me saying then, I guess, that the new book, Goodbye Europe, is a follow-on to the first book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, in as much as it – in the first book, I talked about the organized international terrorism campaign begun by the United States and its repressive and repulsive allies that essentially destroyed South and Southwest Asia and North Africa as well as the Balkans. And you essentially had driven all of these people out of their houses, out of their homes, out of their countries as a result of totally destroyed infrastructure and so on. So in the new book, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, I trace how these people are moved. I talk about the folks who are doing the moving and why they're doing the moving. And essentially, you've got the United States, a number of non-governmental organizations, big business, and our good friend George Soros. And what they've done essentially is herd these people out of their countries through Turkey, which was a holding tank for them until they let them all loose in one huge wave, and they moved north to the Balkans and then into the benefit-rich countries of Central and Northern Europe. And along the way, George Soros and his Central European University got interpreters in really hard, really obscure languages like Dari and Pashtun and Farsi and Arabic and other tongues to act as interpreters to help guide them into Germany and elsewhere. And you had big companies like Cisco Systems contributing large sums of money to NGOs such as NetHope and Mercy Corps, both of which are connected to the Central Intelligence Agency, apparently. And in the case of Mercy Corps, they've had some of their people arrested as espionage agents in the eastern part of the breakaway province of the Ukraine, Luhansk. And you've got, in the book, I talk about how Peter Sutherland, a personal representative for the Office of Migration Control in the United Nations, telling the British House of Lords almost half a dozen years ago that Europe is too monocultural. We need new blood. We need new races. We need new linguistics. We need new ethnics in the continent. And you've got people like Gerard Knaus, who is running a think tank in Austria and who's one of George Soros' graduates from his Open Society. He proposed the idea, along with Diederik Samson, a Dutch politician, to bring in hundreds of thousands of migrants a year, and through an arrangement with Turkey, that they would be able to take some of these people back that the Europeans didn't want. And I go through the crimes they've committed. I go through the out-of-control activities on New Year's Eve 2015 and talk about how the German Internal Security Services somehow missed all of this, how the Federal Criminal Police in Germany somehow missed all of this. And you had really spectacular crimes like this Anas Amri fellow who drove a truck that apparently was stolen into this Christmas market at Breitscheidplatz in the center of Berlin near the Kaiser Wilhelm Church. And he was a guy that somehow managed to slip out of Berlin where the Federal Criminal Police had their headquarters and presumably went all through Germany, all through France, and into Italy where he was somehow shot down in the street in an identity check. You had an Afghan migrant, for example, in Freiburg, the university town in southwest Germany, who raped and drowned a beautiful 19-year-old medical student as he was bicycling home from a party. She had also worked in a home for the migrants, trying to help them out. And the German government sat on this for months, and it only came out when people started talking and hit the internet. Same thing happened in Austria, where an Iraqi guy had a sexual emergency at a swimming pool, and he raped a 10-year-old boy. And this was, again, hushed up with the rather vague statement that, well, we're protecting the identity of the victim. And again, it didn't come to light until people started talking about it on social media and hit the newspapers. So it's a soup-to-nuts, start-to-finish kind of thing where I talk about how essentially the migrants are the real victims because they've been dehoused, deculturalized, destabilized, and destroyed. I mean, they're pulled out of their homes, out of their countries, out of their fatherlands, and cast into an entirely hostile environment. And in the situation they find themselves in, they don't like the host country. The host country people don't like them, and you have this clash set up. And in addition to that, you have the people in the natives of the home countries. The countries in which the migrants have been pushed. They were essentially fighting amongst each other. You have the folks who want to welcome them with candy and flowers, and the other people who say, "Well, we want our country to remain our country and to remain the way it is. We don't want segregated swimming pools. We don't want segregated gym classes," and so forth. And all of this, in a sense, goes back to a book by Kelly M. Greenhill titled Weapons of Mass Migration, in which she talks about this in great detail through a number of chapters, talking about what happens when you drive people out of a country. It weakens it, and when you drive them into the new country, such as Germany or Austria or Sweden or you name it, it weakens them because they have to deal with this influx of aliens that have no ties to their own culture, no language abilities, no education. And it strains their capacity. There was one city councilwoman in Munich who said that we have 50,000 migrants in the city and we got them housed in a sports stadium, but they have no place to sleep except on the ground. We don't even have 50,000 air mattresses in the city to put between them and the dirt. So it's an amazing thing, and how this has been planned and tested. The best pattern was with Korea, where they were trying to drive North Koreans out of North Korea into South Korea or China to weaken North Korea and get a regime change. And this has been the whole pattern with Syria, the whole pattern with Libya, and the whole pattern with the other countries in the region. And I go into excruciating detail sometimes, listing the crimes and who did it, and what the prospects are for the future, which are not terribly good. I say that the way you solve this is you stop the wars in the regions. We've managed to drag the Europeans into the forever war by getting the British, the French, and the Italians and the Germans to bomb Libya, to bomb Iraq, and to bomb Syria. And this just increases the migrant wave. The idea is to take money and put it into migrant camps in their home countries or near their home countries, using the money that's in NATO, using the money that comes from the military budgets of the countries in NATO, and that would solve a lot of the problems, and it would be a cheaper and a better solution where almost everybody wins and few people lose. So that's it in more than 25 words, I guess.
Pretty good. Nice time management there. But I'd like to ask you real quick before we go to others, to what extent do you think that this mass migration in Europe represents a deliberate effort to destabilize Europe itself? And whose interest would that serve if that were the case?
Oh, yes, indeed. I mentioned that in the book. The idea is, it's twofold. The Germans have this absolutely stupid idea that all of these migrants are going to fund their social welfare systems for the next century, and that's not going to happen. It's going to cost more to take care of them than they will produce and put into the system. And as for who's driving this, it's primarily the United States, because it does several things. It weakens Germany. The United States has fought two wars against Germany, and the United States fears Germany and, to a greater or lesser extent, the rest of Europe, with its knowledge, resources, and education and skills and abilities, linking up with the vast Russian landmass and all of its natural resources to become a real economic powerhouse. And the United States doesn't want competition. It wants an American Europe, not as Charles de Gaulle had said, we want a European Europe. So that's the issue, and that's the purpose behind it.
Okay. Thanks. Who else would like to ask a question or make a comment regarding this wonderful new book by Mr. Sherwood?
Well, I'll chime in. Hi, it's Barry. Barry's
Hi, Barry.
In Toronto.
And who else was it that said they had a question?
Bill Wills.
Bill, okay.
James
Hufford. Right after Barry. Bill, okay.
Yeah.
And then James, okay.
Yeah,
James Hufford.
I guess I have two questions for Michael, and I was privileged to be able to write a review of his book, and he knows that I did have some criticisms, but I found the book very valuable, and I would urge anybody to read it. So, Michael, I was wondering if there's a report on about 5 days ago on the Activist Post website, a report by Whitney Webb about a UN report, and the headline is UN report reveals three nations producing most refugees were targets of U.S. intervention. And this is a book that very much, this is a report that very much backs up what you say in your book. And I'll just quote just three brief pieces from it before I ask you the question. The lead says the United Nations report has shed light on the world's burgeoning crisis of displaced peoples, finding that a record of 65.6 million were forced to vacate their homes in 2016 alone, and then more than half of them were minors. The second rather remarkable statistic is that one person is being displaced every 3 seconds, as he says, less than the time it takes to read this sentence. And then the third most important thing is that Webb reports, what the UN report failed to mention was the role of U.S. foreign intervention, indirect or direct, in fomenting the conflicts responsible for producing most of the world's refugees. And so, Michael, I was wondering, A, if you happen to have seen this report that very much backs up your book, and B, how could it be that the UN would fail to mention this central fact that U.S. foreign intervention has produced most of the refugees?
Well, I've not seen the report you're referring to, Barry, but I did see figures from the UN's publications and from the International Office of Migration, where they said that the three countries, and I, for the life of me, I can't remember the third at the moment, it's Syria, it's Somalia, and I can't think of what the third one is at the moment, but they account for most of the migrants in their millions.
Yeah, well, actually, and, Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, millions.
Well, exactly. And I'm sorry, the second question, I missed that.
Well, the second question is, and this goes back to a criticism, if you will, that I,
mm-hmm.
I mentioned in my review about Angela Merkel. And it seemed to me that there was a contradiction in your book in that you more or less lay the blame on her for bringing on the migrant crisis, especially to Germany, and
mm-hmm.
yet other places in the book, you say it's a U.S.-led strategy to create these refugees for different
mm-hmm.
purposes, some of which were already mentioned in this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So, have you do you see somehow that maybe there is a contradiction, or have you, and if you have, how would you reconcile those different viewpoints?
Well, I don't see the break or the contradiction. I think that, one, of course, Merkel has been described by one of Tony Blair's advisors as being a ruthless political operative. And as examples that I cite in the book, the fact that she'd been the protege of Helmut Kohl, and somehow, somewhere, all of this information about his underhanded fiscal dealings, his fraudulent activities, and his general crookedness in sticking money into wrong pockets came out, and he was no longer chairman of the party. The guy who would have been logical to put into the party was Lothar de Maizière, who had been East Germany's last communist, non-communist, leader, and Angela Merkel was a mentee of his. And all of a sudden, when he was ready to step into place as the logical head of the Christian Democratic Union, the center-right party in Germany, all of his information about his Stasi connections, the East German Internal Security Service, came out. And I'm inclined to think it came from Mama Merkel. I think, in addition, Merkel's 35 years living and working in East Germany, being an agitator, being a propaganda artist for the Free German Youth, I think influenced and colored her activities and her viewpoint towards the migrants and what she wanted to do to Germany. I think that she believes to some extent that, as I mentioned earlier, the people coming in will pay into the welfare system, which is one German economist said is not going to happen. It's going to cost them $1 trillion U.S. dollars. And I think also that Merkel really doesn't much care about Germany. She doesn't much care about anything except being perhaps an American poodle. I think she does a lot of what the Americans want her to do. She isn't complaining, for example, about the continued U.S. occupation of the country. And I think that with Merkel's situation, she does pretty much what the American government wants to do. She likes the idea of NATO. She likes the idea of intervention around the world, if only from the sidelines. And, for example, the Schroeder, who had been a socialist chancellor in Germany 2 years ago when the Americans were fighting Iraq, he didn't participate directly in the war, but he did everything he could to grease the skids for the Americans to move soldiers and equipment through Germany and out of the country and then into the Middle East. So it's the Germans say one thing and do something else. So I think that's how I can reconcile it, that in the short run, Merkel thinks this is good for Germany. In the long run, she doesn't much care because it's whatever the Americans want.
Well, that's a very compelling argument you make, Michael. And your time in Germany and your further experience and knowledge of it are superior. So I've listened to that with great interest. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Barry.
All right. Anybody else have a question or a comment?
James Hufford.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. We had two other people, Bill and then James. Bill, go ahead. Make it quick.
This is a little out in left field, I suppose, but as to the crimes committed by these refugees and so on, do you think there is any nexus between the, I guess we could call it the global pedophile ring or, human trafficking? Is that stirred into this mix, or would that be just kind of an ancillary, accidental?
I'd say the latter. I when I did the book, I didn't see any international pedophile ring, for example. I mean, the pedophiles in Germany are the Greens, and Sylvia Germack, who helped me with the introduction or the foreword, she wrote something for that, is very big on this and follows it very closely in Europe. I think it's more along the lines of you got a lot of bad people mixing with some real genuine refugees and asylees. And the problem was they were so overloaded with people that I was told by the Austrian embassy here in Washington that we just didn't keep track of these people. There were so many coming in, we just simply brought them in and passed them on. And that was done, for example, in Croatia, according to what I read and what I got from this Pavla Klinich, who is their equivalent of the Department of Homeland Security head. He said they just simply kept them coming. And in Slovenia next door, this guy said that they just simply created an internal channel and funneled these people through the channel into the next country, which was Austria.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that response. And Jane Telford.
Okay, well, I've seen implications of this. To what extent did you find George Soros' fingerprints on this, either planning the policy or operationalizing it?
Well, I was surprised. I had always heard people going on about Soros and the demon of the financial world, and but nobody ever really said what he did or how he did it. And in researching the book, I could see it. It was his Central European universities, I mentioned, who got all these interpreters. He apparently set up, Facebook apps or iPhone apps or some sort of deal where he could ensure that these people could use their smartphones to navigate. They didn't have topographical maps. In a lot of instances, these phones somehow got distributed to people, and I did a little research on what the phones cost in Syria, for example, and they're, about what you charge here for a cell phone. And granted, you can probably get used ones and secondhand ones or reconditioned ones or something, and then it might not be quite the equivalent of $500 or so, but then on the other hand, the average wage in Damascus, the capital, is $50 a month. So how many months are you going to have to work to buy a cell phone? I figured it's anywhere from several months to almost 9 months in a year to pay for this stuff. And, of course, these are the guys that don't have jobs, who drop their jobs and pack up and go. And then you have all these unaccompanied minors, especially young boys in their teens. Where do they get the money for these things? Where does that come from? And I think Soros' money is going into this, although I couldn't put my finger on it exactly. But his Open Society is being very helpful to all of this. As I mentioned, this Gerald Canales in Austria, he's one of the Open Society's graduates. The woman who, Meredith Wu, who became the president of Sweetbriar College in the southeastern United States, she was one of George Soros' people at his head of his Open Society office in London. And according to the newspaper article I read and the Open Society website, they talked about how they helped all these immigrants and all these migrants, but didn't say exactly what they did.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the money has to come from someplace, and it all doesn't come from the Central Intelligence Agency. I think Soros pumps a little money into this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But that's speculation on my part based on what I've seen.
Interesting. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Well, does anybody else have a good pressing question, or shall we move on to our next agenda item?
This is Neil. I would like to ask one, please.
All right, Neil, and then we're going to move on. Go ahead, Neil.
Okay. Michael, I just wanted to know if you've thought of the notion of famine as being an independent cause of the refugee crisis.
No, I haven't addressed famine in particular. I just simply talked about the total destruction of the various countries' economies. I mentioned about Syria at one point, where they were moving from an agricultural economy to an industrial economy maybe 30, 40 years ago. And I think it's easy to disrupt either one. You know, how much does it take to knock out the roads or knock out the irrigation systems? Because Syria gets about 10 inches of rain on average a year.
Right. Okay.
So it's not hard to hit either one.
Mm. Oh, great. Michael, thank you so much for
you're quite welcome. I appreciate the opportunity to talk.
Very informative. I hope others will consider going out and purchasing a copy and getting even more informed. Thanks for sharing your time, Michael.
Thank you.
Okay, so now it's time for Wayne Costi to give us a few minutes of updating us on some things that he apparently didn't get quite correct the first time. So go ahead, Wayne, you have a few minutes. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Ken. Thanks for giving me the opportunity. You know, one of the things that I've found is that it's really hard to get a lot of straight information about what happened at the Pentagon, and even I have misstated things in the past, and I just wanted to take some time to correct them. The presentation you're going to see, you can get to this by going to the usual website, which is hopeoutloud.org, hopeoutloud.org/Pentagon. And this is the top presentation that you would see. It says Wedge 1, Construction and Destruction. But this was sparked to some extent by a video that I was able to get out of the library through interlibrary loan by American Heat in there's probably been about five truthers in the world who have ever seen this particular video of 9/11 raw footage, and it's called "Inside the Pentagon" by American Heat. It's available through the Toledo, Ohio Community College interlibrary loan, and that's where I got it from. There's one particular image that kind of struck me, and I just had to keep looking into it. And I was ultimately able to figure out how the walls were actually built. In the past, I had said that they were, like so many other truthers have said, that they were reinforced concrete, backed, lots of bricks and limestone. And I want to go through it, and I'm going to be using the slide numbers on the hopeoutloud.org/Pentagon. Wedge 1, Construction Destruction. So I'll just kind of zoom through this. I only have about 10 minutes, so I'm going to try to make it pretty quick. I go to slide 4. The overview is basically kind of why are we doing this? The Pentagon wall has been subject to a lot of confusion. It's frequently referred to as a massive and blast-resistant. You know, Massimo Mizzuto says the same thing, but in fact it's far less structurally formidable. The detailed analysis of the wall is available. A little detailed of the analysis is available in 9/11 Truth Circles about what's actually how it's actually built. Many who speak about the Pentagon repeat the assertions of a massive and steel reinforced. And as I said, I've done that. Slide 5. The review of the construction prior to 9/11 shows much smaller wall mass. The older estimate I gave was 96 tons. My new guess is 75 tons for a 100-foot opening. The connections to the wall to the upper and lower slab is now much better understood, and you'll see them in the images in the presentation. There's through bolt connections from one floor to the other, and I suspect that has something to do with why the wall in front of a column 14 was actually effectively pulled down because it was bolted to the ones below it and with a lot of destruction in the area. But I don't have any good – that's speculation on my part there. But it does kind of make sense when you see how these were built. Slide 6 is a typical picture that I've used before, in which doesn't have any basis in fact for the wall sections between column 8 and 18 on the first floor. There was limestone and there was some brick, but there was no concrete. That may have been appropriate for another part of the wall. Slide 7 shows what the walls actually did look like. There was infill brick along the side. There was steel frame, and there was some infill brick on the this is on the outside, below the windowsill, and I suppose probably above the windowsill too. We'll be talking about that in a little bit. If I go to slide 9, slides 9 through about 13 will give some of the design parameters. They talk about if they this is from an article by the designers. On slide 9 it says the idea of supporting the brick infill walls with reinforced concrete backing was rejected. That's what the designers said. The selected approach was to use vertical tubes, giving a blast protection to those walls, as we'll see. Slide 10, the long, narrow plates running along the floor and ceiling, they were bolted to their counterparts on the floor above. We'll see some of that when you look at the post-collapse wall damage. Slide 11, this is important here because on the first floor, they core drilled a hole into the slab to accommodate the tube. That's why you're going to see the window tube to the right of column 9AA is still embedded in the concrete and just bent inwards. Slide 12 just talks about why that these are basically blast resistant windows, not walls. Slide 14 is a picture of the walls that are being constructed. I don't know which floor it is. I assume that is, in fact, like a second or third floor because we have bolts coming up from the bottom. But it shows the construction is the steel tubes, the fingers that are used to support the windows. And you can see the columns that are kind of marked out. So that's kind of one of the pictures of the building while it's being constructed. Slide 15 shows it, another zoom in. This is from one of the reconstruction brochures. It shows the steel frame, the blast-resistant windows, and the Kevlar, which they call a geotechnical mesh. Slide 16 is kind of a zoom in to look at some of the bolts. It's not a very clear photo. There's actually better ones actually in some of the other slides. Slide 17 is another photo as the windows are being built and put into place, and I've got the links to the archive.org sites where you can find these, and this is dated March 2000, so this is all clearly before 9/11. Slide 19, zooming onto that, shows the post-event wall. This is a second floor window. You can see the Kevlar. You can actually, as you zoom in, you can see the fabric marking. You can see the window frame, the fingers holding the window, and in this case here, you can see the melted blast-resistant window. Slide 20 is a different window taken. And you can see, again, there's a brick infill to the right of the steel frame. There's what appears to be fiberglass in the hollow between what would have been the wall and the Kevlar. Just another picture. Slide 21, we're looking on the outside. You can see the window frame
tube to the right of column 9AA. And then if you look to the left, you can see the window to the left of column 8. You can see the fingers holding, supporting the window frame. Again, it's all these pictures are consistent. I'll skip to slide 22. Now we're looking at down, since all the windows in wedge 1 were done at the same time, this is looking down at column 3, the window to the left of column 3. Just more of the same construction. Slide 23 is just a different version of that. Just pointing it out, you can see the brick infill, in this case here, has on the right-hand side, has fallen away for top 6 or so feet. But you can see the brick infill as it was. Slide 24 shows the kind of a close-up of the steel tube next to column AA. That's from the ASCE Pentagon report. Slide 25, and this is the one that I got out of the American Heat inside the Pentagon that started me on this journey. Just the window frame here shortly after they've started to build the supports got me to actually, what the heck are these things? And how do I explain what they are? And why is this beam standing here? Why has it been left for a week? So zooming on to slide 26, we can answer part of that question. We've got a picture as they're starting to put up a frame, but you can look in the bottom left-hand corner, you can see this steel tube and part of how it was connected to the base slab. Now, if you go to I'll just go through this really quick here. Slide 28 is looking at, gives a little background on the post-collapse wall photos, and we're going to look at a little bit about the steel window frames, supports that are there, the blast-resistant windows. So if we go to slide 29, it's kind of a high-level overview, giving you a little bit of a overview of what we have here. We've got the limestone. So you can see the limestone, the bricks, the steel window frames, and the blast-resistant windows, and the Kevlar is the white, kind of the white stuff under the greenish-tinted burnt windows. Slide 30 kind of zooms in, and what you can see here is how, I guess I'm going to go to the next couple of slides. Slide 31 shows the kind of the disconnect between the upper and on one floor steel tubes and the lower ones on the floor below, and you can see some of the steel bolt connectors between them. Slide 32 kind of zooms in. You can see the through bolt connections. Slide 33 shows about the same, different viewpoint, different photograph, different photographer. Slide 34 is just a picture of a video. If you want to click on the link of the wall collapsing, that's Bob Pug had said that it sounded like a crunch, and he looked over and saw it collapsing. And so that's kind of the wall. I mean, the whole point is I've made the mistake in the past of saying that the building was the wall had a significant amount of concrete. Matter of fact, I spent a couple of months going back and forth with someone who said it couldn't be because it took too much energy to break up the wall, to break concrete. He used to do break up concrete. It'd be impossible for a plane to do that. And in fact, now that I know this, I would have said there's no concrete. You know, if there's other people who can find pictures of concrete, glad to look at them. I think I've gone through and looked at the post-collapse walls, the post-event walls on other floors, which should be similar to the ones on the first floor, and the ones that are on the first floor but not in the collapse area, and they all show the same thing. So with that, I'll end and turn it over for questions if there are any. Over.
All right. Thank you. Does anybody have any questions or have a comment, a quick comment?
Craig? Craig, I'll ask it.
Okay, Craig.
Yeah, I have two questions. The first one is, what you're saying about the wall now, how does that affect, I mean, one of the big contradictions, I think, about the impact theory is that the plane is alleged to have
penetrated, that the fuselage is alleged to have penetrated the facade and gone 300 feet into the building, but other parts of the plane are supposed to have been kind of blown into confetti. So I guess my question is, how is that contradiction affected by what you're saying about the wall now, that it doesn't have the reinforced concrete? And my second one is maybe a little easier than that. It's just the blast resistant windows. Is it your contention that the blast resistant windows could take the impact of any part of the plane, or would they in fact shatter if they were hit by any part of the plane?
Well, thanks, Craig. Let me answer the first one because that is the easiest. The contention, I think it's really pretty obvious, is that the entire wall was just frankly pushed in. Blast-resistant window or not, the whole frame was disconnected from it. It was, if you look at the pictures, the one that shows the bolts coming up from the a lower floor, there's only about 7 or 8 of them per segment, and they're only 5/8-inch bolts. And so it appears that the blast-resistant window was what they put in, but the damage was that the entire wall was just pushed in completely. And you can see remnants of that in the direction of the bend in the bow in column 9AA and the bent-in window frame piece next to it. So now going to your other part, there's always this phrase about the things being turned to confetti, and I know that you've referred to David Chandler's comments on that. I basically don't see why there would be a huge amount of this stuff called confetti. It looks like most of the, my talk here tonight is about the wall, the construction, the error, but frankly, all you had to do was get the plane, most of the plane, inside the building, under the collapse zone. It doesn't have to go 300 feet through it. Something, if a piece of the plane made the C-ring exit hole, then something would have gone through 300 feet and hit a two-layer brick wall that was 19 feet unsupported brick. So something could have gone through there. But the whole point is that with the wall being effectively just a couple of just a half a dozen bolts between the floors, between columns, there's not a lot actually holding this in place. And the plane, all it has to do is go inside there, and you're not going to see the plane parts. You're not going to see, like Mizuto, when he talked about the reinforced concrete wall, reinforced concrete wall is what he said. He showed a picture of a plane that obviously crashed hundreds of feet in front of it, slid to about 100 feet in front, and he says, well, this is what it looks like if it hit the wall. And, if the wall is hit, it's going to give. There's just not that much to it. It's not the solid, massive wall that everyone that I've talked to, and I'm embarrassed that I've had to make this correction myself, that someone didn't point out and say, Wayne, don't you know that there's like no concrete there? I've looked at so many of these, I've looked at thousands of photos, and finally it dawns on me that there's no concrete. And many of the arguments that I've made in the past about, well, the concrete would have given way, just doesn't even fit anymore. So I hope I answered your question. And if you want to tell Chandler, I said the confetti issue is overplayed. There shouldn't be so much. It just goes through the wall, largely intact. Not completely, of course, but largely intact. You can tell him I said that.
Well, I'm not sure he wants to hear from me, but I'll, if I am talking to him, I'll let him know.
Okay. Thanks, Craig. Anybody else want to ask a question or make a comment?
Yeah, this is Dwayne.
Dwayne, go ahead.
I found these very interesting, given that I've spent a lot of time looking at the remains of this wall. I learned a lot by looking at the photos that Wayne provided. And I think one thing I'd have less confidence in saying, I think a a large plane is what did the damage, as I've thought did happen. But I also would say the idea of inside explosions causing this isn't supported by what Wayne presented. So I'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll simply respond. The one place where I have seen what appears to be a concrete wall seems to be about on the third floor to the right of the where the stairwell is. So that's around columns 21, 22, someplace around there. If you look at some of the photos, you'll see some concrete blocks that look like they're right behind where a window opening. So don't know what they were doing there, but it's not the impact area. And as far as the internal explosions go, the only thing that I can see that is really too hard to explain, and yet I have no explanation for it, is the uplifted section of the concrete slab that the ASCE reported. That you can go into their report and see it's been uplifted 18 inches. I can't imagine what would have done that. But again. And none of the photos I see done by Jocelyn Augustino and others inside the Pentagon kind of show that area so clearly. I don't even know where it is in relationship. And I don't see anything that looks like huge explosion. I don't see anything that looks like things blown outwards in all directions.
Okay.
So,
all right. Any other questions or comments before we move on to our last agenda item? All right. Well, thank you, Wayne, for the update and for the very remarkably detailed graphics that you supplied. Hopefully everybody will get a chance to take a closer look at them later on. I know I'm going to try. And finally,
Ken, are you there?
Oh, sorry about that. I muted myself instead. James, I just had to mute you because the coughing there was getting out of hand. But we'll now move on to our last item on the agenda. Barbara requested some time, which I think is very appropriate, to talk about the Left Forum and its surprisingly successful results, given the oppression that it was receiving from the Left Forum powers that be. So, Barbara, you want to introduce it? Oh, I'll bet you Barbara's on mute.
I just unmuted her.
Oh, okay. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I was trying to get through to ask Wayne something.
You can, Barbara. The reason you were on mute was because there was a lot of noise coming through your microphone and you had to be muted, so I apologize for that. Sometimes you just have to do that, okay?
Well, I don't know what the noise could have been. Okay, anyway. Wayne, I wish I had your slide set in front of me, but is the bottom line of what you said that you needed to correct that there's now evidence that there wasn't any concrete in the Wedge 1 hardened wall?
No, that's correct. The only place I see concrete is in the actual columns that were pre-existing. Other than that, it's just infill brick along the front and along the sides and limestone in front. And photos from the inside, from the outside, pre-collapse, post-collapse, no places there any concrete. And, in fact, that's the document was captured on the 9/11 research website that has the engineers that built it talking about the construction. Basically, say there was no concrete. It would not have fit well. It would not have fit with the design of the Pentagon with all the windows. So you can look at that material. Over.
Right. It's my understanding that. There's many people in the movement have used this graphic that I believe was from the Pentagon Building Performance Report, and it had limestone, it had brick, and it had the Kevlar material, but I don't believe it had concrete, did it?
I don't know. I don't recall the particular graphic like
people have used in the movement, so to speak, except the one that has the that shows a lot of concrete. Which is why I was so shocked when I finally, after seeing this American Heat video with the fire newsletter team came in and videoed these things, and they had this one photo. And I said, I have to go dig into what this is. It was really one of the best photos I'd seen of that particular piece. But there's no concrete that I can find, and if you can find photos, the reason I make these presentations is you all know that Wayne says lots of stuff, but I keep waiting for people to tell me where I'm wrong and what needs to be corrected and give me a counterexample. So if you can find one or find someone who's got something, let me know.
Okay, and could you, two other things, could you give us the name? I could not hear it, this important video you say maybe five people have seen. American Heat, H-E-A-T?
Yeah, it's American Heat. It's inside the Pentagon. It's a 2000 was published in November 2001. Firefighters came in. There's two copies. There used to be three copies in the interlibrary loan system. I've been trying to get it for years. Finally called up Owens Library, which is Toledo Community College, and they said, "Yeah, I can get you that. We'll just have your library request it, and you can get it." And it's kind of a news report about going to the Pentagon and interviewing it's for firefighters talking about fighting the fire. Two copies. The one's at Owens in Toledo. The other one's at Florida State University in Jacksonville. The third one I was going to go see on a trip, they threw away because it's 2001, and it's a VHS video cassette. So if you're going to go request it, make sure you can play a video cassette, because I found out that I couldn't.
So did you make a digital version of this you could share with us?
I would not ever say anything like that at all. You can order it through Interlibrary Loan through Owens Library, Toledo, Ohio. Interlibrary Loan. It's really
O-W-E-N-S Library.
And Toledo, Ohio, Community College, yeah.
Okay, and then the other comment I have is, it's just a fact. I'm not really sure why you mentioned what you did about the what's called confetti, because it's just a fact that there are large numbers of pieces, extremely small pieces of debris, wreckage, whatever it is, that was called confetti-like by many, many, many eyewitnesses who were there.
Yeah. So Barbara, the word confetti, as you have alluded to, is a very imprecise word, and people have used it in many different ways. And if you want to have a discussion of confetti, you and Craig can come up with a common definition.
My point, I don't care what you call it. My point is there are an extremely large number of small pieces of apparently metal all over the place.
Yes, I certainly agree. And I pointed them out in other prior presentations, but that's
right.
Really pretty peripheral to what I'm talking about. So I'd like...
You're not questioning that reality, right?
Oh no.
Okay.
Sure, plenty of confetti.
Oh, okay.
But
so that point's clear.
Can you move on
Thank
to the left form?
Yes. Go on to the left form, please. Thank you.
Well, I would invite Cheryl to go first because she was one of the co-organizers of this great event.
Okay. I guess, do people just want an overview of what happened that day? I'm not sure what people know and what they don't know. Is that kind of what people would like?
Well, you might do a real quick capsule overview of the history behind it, just to refresh people that might not be familiar with it, and then go from there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. So the Left Forum is in New York City at John Jay College every year. And last year, Kat McGuire and I had six panels on 9/11 and the global war on terror and presidential assassinations, and I can't remember all of them, but we had six of them. They were all approved, no problem. This year we had five panels, and they were all last year were in a deep state track as well as this year, and the Left Forum gave us a hard time about it because some guy named Spencer Sunshine wrote them a letter and said that we shouldn't be allowed to be there, that we were fascist, anti-Semitic, etc. We responded to that. They let us see that letter, and we responded. And then when we submitted our panels, they only approved of two of them, and three they didn't, and they had problems with Kevin Barrett was in one of them. And then they had problems with people who were on last year but we didn't have this year. So anyway, we all they did is tell us that they were canceled. They didn't tell us why. They didn't say anything to us. We tried to inquire, and they didn't respond. So then we were kind of at a loss of what to do with these, you know, do we withdraw all of our panels? Do we keep the two we had, et cetera? So then the last week, they then they banned one of our panels that they had approved, and they sent us a note to that effect. And they said that there was a German group that had complained about us, and it turns out that they were one of their funders, and then that they said they'd received thousands or hundreds of letters of people complaining about it. And it was Anthony Hall that they had a concern with. They said he was a Holocaust denier. And, you know, they never asked us about any of that. They never asked Anthony to, you know, talk to them and you know, give his side of the story or anything. So we tried to contact them and talk to them about that, and we didn't get any, you know, air. So then Kat and I didn't quite know what to do, and then the only reason we really succeeded in all of this is because of the group effort from everyone in the community who just really supported what we were doing. And it was including a lot of you on this, Paul, who wrote letters to them when they had were threatening our first three panels. And so anyway, someone in New York, Eric Rossi, was really upset that they were banning our panels, and so he went and rented some space in John Jay College right near where they were having the Left Forum. And then we even rented a backup place in a hotel in case they got wind of this, that we were in John Jay, and tried to cancel that. We had an anonymous donor help to pay for these extra rooms, so it all just fell through really nicely, came out. And we did not release the location until we had rented a table at the Left Forum, which we did last year, and so we had a central location. We had flyers posted up on our table saying that we had been banned, that we were going to have them, and we weren't going to release the location until Sunday morning, and they were all on Sunday. So that created such a stir that I think we had huge attendance. We had between 40 and 70 people at our banned panels at any given time. And, you know, people were really upset about it, and so it created a lot of tension for the Left Forum. So we had them. They were very successful. They were archived at No Lies Radio, so you can see them there. Videotaped, and Kat and I have since written a letter to the board of the Left Forum asking for some reimbursement financially for the people who, some of them were already had bought their tickets or were on their way to New York at the time they let us know that they were canceling that fourth panel. That went out over a week ago. We haven't heard from them, so we'll be following up with phone calls and stuff. You know, we've asked them about what are they going to do for next year, you know, and that kind of thing. So so we're waiting to hear from them. But again, it was really successful based on just the support of our larger community. So I want to thank everyone who was involved in that.
And Barbara, did you want to add anything?
Well, just from the point of view of a speaker, we had, maybe Cheryl would be able to give, wasn't it something like 15, 16 speakers, Cheryl, in our panels?
Five panels times roughly three, so 15, yeah.
About 15 speakers, and I had the opportunity to be in two of the panels, one on 9/11 with Richard Gage and Kevin Barrett, and the other one with J. Michael Springman and myself and Jane Clark, both Michael and Jane. I don't know if they're still on the call.
I'm still here in the basement.
Oh, yeah, okay. And Les Jamison and Sander Hicks was the moderator of that. I just encourage everybody who hasn't watched these panels to watch them and go to noliesradio.org/leftforum, and I believe that they are now free to watch, every single one of them. You might have to scroll down a bit to click on a link to actually get to the videos, and they're vertically one after the other in the chronological order in which they occurred. And it was just incredibly successful. And Cheryl Curtis and Kat McGuire did a fantastic job pulling this off. It was truly above and beyond, so they're to be congratulated. And so everybody, please advertise to your list, all of your list, where people can go and watch these Left Forum panels. The videos are pretty good quality.
Yeah, and I just want to also add that we were in John Jay College, and the morning that we were doing our panels in the room that was just down the hall from where they were having the Left Forum, the guards came in and asked us if we had a contract for the room. And luckily we had thought about that and printed one out so we could show it to them. And then they left us alone. So, and I do thank you, Barbara, for your kind words, but I do, you know, we wouldn't have been able to pull it off if it hadn't been for everybody else, you know, coming together around it. So.
Well, that's true, but yeah. You were the omen. And we had a wonderful time. Just had a great time. All
we
of us, both
did.
Nights, we went to a deli, and I think we must have had close to 50 people in the restaurant at one point. I mean, it was just really a positive, wonderful time.
It really
and
was.
And we made lemonade out of lemon.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think the choice of title, the Left Out Forum, was very, very clever, whoever thunk that one up.
I think that was Alan Reese of No Lies Radio.
Alan Reese, good for him. Cheryl, did you ever find out the name of that German organization that had so much trouble with you guys?
We think it was the Rosa Luxemburg, and maybe Michael, if he's still on, can tell us the last name of that, Stick something. Do you remember?
Yeah, the Stiftung, it's Foundation.
Okay. And we've since done a little research on them and discovered that they are connected to the sort of funding of the Nazis in the Ukraine. And
we
let the left forum
know that. No wonder they're calling you fascists.
Exactly. we did send that research to the Left Forum board, but haven't heard back.
Isn't that rich? One of the organizations that complained about us and is funding the Left Forum is this Nazi organization complaining that we're anti-Semitic.
Yes, exactly.
Well, these are the same people that are tied in with the what's left of the old East German Communist Party, the left called in German Die Linke.
Uh-huh. Mm.
So maybe with the Stasi and all that good stuff, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other comment on this before we move on to announcements? All right. Well, congratulations, Cheryl, Barbara, and everybody that pulled that one off. And let's move on to announcements now. Anybody have any for this month?
Craig?
Craig, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a couple that actually were passed on to me by Pablo Shanes. He couldn't be with us, but he asked me to present these. One of them is the fact that Steve Diak, who has been heading up the 9/11 crash test project, is looking to he's still sort of running it, but is quite willing to hand it over to someone else if someone else is interested in taking the project over. And so you can contact him. You can contact him at steve@911crashtest.org. Mm-hmm. Anybody that wants to get involved with that or to take it over can do that.
Yeah. I'll probably have to go in the minutes, okay?
Yeah, indeed. Yes, I have it ready to go. Also, Pablo wanted me to mention with respect to the Unity Manifesto that we worked on as our teleconference and voted on the final result of. He said that he is sort of promoting that on a Facebook group called International 9/11 Fraud Awareness Week. I think the name was chosen before the manifesto was involved. I have a link to that Facebook that'll go in the minutes as well. And so he just sort of wanted to draw attention to that. He's one of the administrators. Pablo is one of the administrators of that Facebook page. And also he wanted to let us know that he's created kind of a photo version of the manifesto itself, like it's been turned into an image. It's the same thing, but just so that you can share it easily, I guess, on Facebook and different places. So I will attach I will attach the photo version of the manifesto to the minutes as well. So And also, if you, yeah, I think I also have his, yeah, if you wanted to get in touch with him with respect to the manifesto or getting involved with promoting that in any way, he gave me his email address as well, which is NoviPablo, N-O-V-I, Pablo, at protonmail.com. So I'll include that as well. So that's it.
Okay. Any other announcements?
Dwayne?
Dwayne, go ahead.
Yeah, this is kind of a sad announcement. The San Diego 9/11 Truth Group has kind of brought to an end the monthly meetings that it's had for over 10 years. It's going to be more of an ad hoc. It'll try to arrange a meeting if we have a speaker that is of importance, but other than that, we won't have the monthly regular meetings. And I think what I will do is not be listed as a San Diego 9/11 Truth contact anymore. I am the regional coordinator for TAP, 9/11 TAP in California and Nevada, so you can list me in that way. That's it.
Okay. Thank you. And who else has an announcement?
This is Cheryl.
I have
Go ahead, Barb.
Cheryl and then Barb. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Okay. I just got an email, and I think this is interesting. Maybe it was the U.S. Conference of Mayors on Monday unanimously passed three resolutions opposing military-heavy Trump budget proposal, and the resolution urges Congress to reverse the budget and move funding out of the military wars and nuclear weapons and into human and environmental needs. So that the mayors are getting smarter.
Cool. All right. And Barbara?
Well, I just want to draw people's attention to the amazing fact, because it slipped people's minds because it's not in the press, that the 9/11 five, the alleged mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other four alleged, you know, masterminds of 9/11 and co-conspirators, they're still just, you know, being held at Guantanamo. And their cases are effectively paralyzed. They've been on a kind of perpetual hold because of, quote, problems, unquote, with the hearings. And that was just in the New York Times the other day. If people are interested, I can send the link to that story. It's just a paragraph in another story about the Trump administration seriously considering moving the Hambali, Bali bombing and Jakarta bombings, terrorist attack cases forward with this Hambali person who's being held at Guantanamo. But there's a passing mention of the fact that the 9/11 five are just sitting there and nothing's happening.
Mm-hmm. Lest we forget. Okay. Thank you. So, and any other announcements?
Yeah, this is Wayne.
Wayne, go ahead.
So the upcoming July 4th, I don't have a lot of the details, but the Boston 9/11 Truth Group usually gets together near the Esplanade on the Charles River to hand out flyers. And if anyone's in the Boston area wants to help out on July 4th, that's a great place to go. And I understand to watch some really spectacular fireworks and do some 9/11 Truth work. Over.
Okay, thank you. Any other announcements? All right, then. Looks like that does it for tonight. Kind of a long one, but probably I hope y'all found it was worthwhile. And we'll see you the last Wednesday of July for the next one. Be active till then. See you then. Good night.
Good night.
Okay,
bye.
Thanks.
Okay.
Good night, bye. Night, all. Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, Ken.
Mm-hmm.
Should we stop the recording?
Oh, thank you, yeah. Mm-hmm.